The Islamic people of Iran could not be seen with the man the entire world thought wanted to bring it down. The harsh chime of Sasani's mobile phone wormed its way into his dreamless sleep. The mattress in his Herat hotel room was too soft, but it was more comfortable than the couch in his office. "It is up and running, Major," the voice said when he answered. "I apologize for waking you, but I thought you would want to know at once." Sasani sniffed and then looked around the room, blinking away the memories of the day before. "What is up and running?" "The satellite phone you ordered me to monitor." Sasani sat up a little straighter at that. "At this very moment?" "Yes," the technician said. "And we have audio. The caller is an Azeri woman, speaking to, we believe, her mother. The caller's name is Nima." "Origination," Sasani snapped. He was on his feet now, pacing at the foot of his hotel bed. "She is calling from Mashhad, Major."
"Mashhad?"
Sasani stopped in his tracks. "She is calling from inside Iran?"
"Yes, Major. It is difficult to pinpoint an exact address, but we are reasonably certain the phone is being used not far from the shrine of the Imam at this very moment."
"Bracket in," Sasani said. "I want as close a location as you are able to give me."
"Yes, Major," the technician said.
"You say the speaker's name is Nima?"
"Correct," the technician said.
Sasani ended the call. He pitched the phone on the bed and rubbed his hands together, thinking. He wondered if Nima would make this easy or difficult. Fatima had made it difficult. He sighed. Difficult was certainly much more interesting.
Chapter 55. Something brushed Jack's elbow. His back was painfully knotted and stiff. The shoulder nearest the floor, wedged against something hard, throbbed with a sickening ache, like the time he'd wrenched it out of its socket. The touch came again, accompanied by a distant voice. Isabel's voice. A dream, maybe? Surely he'd been asleep only a few minutes. Jack tried to open his eyes, but they were glued shut, refusing to cooperate. The pain in his injured ear came next, pulsing in time with his heartbeat. He wondered if that was a good sign or bad. Isabel spoke again, closer now, an urgent whisper, pushing aside the fog.
"Jack, wake up."
Ryan sat bolt upright, searching the room to get his bearings. It took him a moment to remember where he was. Dovzhenko had heard the voice, too, and was up on one elbow, eyes flicking, listening.
"I'm sorry,"
Isabel said. She'd showered and covered her torn clothing with a borrowed smock. Jack saw Nima standing in the kitchen, which was really just a corner of the same room. She was dressed now, in a dark skirt and a knee-length khaki top that reminded Ryan of a cotton pillowcase. Steam came from a kettle set over the blue flame of a two-burner gas stove. People didn't make tea in the middle of an emergency. He rubbed his face, wincing at the jab of pain the movement caused his injured ear.
"Sorry for what?"
"Please don't be mad at her, Jack," Isabel said. "She didn't know."
Jack stood on wooden legs, feeling a half-dozen more sprains than he'd felt the night before. Whatever this news was, he didn't want to get it lying down. His neck felt as if someone had tried to twist it off his shoulders, and he was pretty sure he'd chipped a tooth. And that didn't even take into account the fact that his ear was hanging on by 9 stitches of catgut put in by an opium smuggler. Old age was going to be a hell of a lot of fun, if he made it that far. He looked at Isabel and smiled in spite of the situation when he saw her.
"What are you talking about?"
She nodded toward the satellite phone on the table. A sudden chill washed over Jack. "What's this?" Dovzhenko saw it too, and jumped to his feet. Isabel gave a sheepish grin.
"Nima's mobile phone is broken. She hadn't talked to her mother in months."
Jack took a couple of deep breaths, working to keep his voice calm.
"Did she already make the call?"
Isabel nodded. "She was talking when I woke up."
Jack had to concentrate to keep his voice at a whisper.
"How did she—"
"She must have taken it from the briefcase while we were asleep," Isabel said.
"I checked the call log.
It looks like she spoke for less than 3 minutes. She assured me she never mentioned us or said where she was.
Nima glanced up from the kettle.
I will pay for the call, she said. I didn't think anyone would mind. No worries, Ryan said, though he had plenty. He changed the subject. Did you sleep well? Dovzhenko was already tying on his boots. Nima, he said, you must leave at once.
She waved off the thought.
I have many appointments today, she said. The call was only for a moment. I doubt even the Sepa Yepazdaran are that all-seeing. Still, Isabel said, Eric is right. You should not take that chance. You worry far too much, Nima said. I will be fine, I promise.
Isabel turned to Jack.
You should let me look at that ear before we go.
Later, Ryan said, turning to head for the bathroom. We need to go. Now. Dovzhenko turned on the radio, filling the cab with techno guitar music. Isabel, who'd taken shotgun again, turned sideways to glare at him. He reached to turn it off, but not before a deep Persian voice came over the air, sounding somber and somewhat nasal, like a muezzin's call to prayer. Ryan couldn't understand what was being said, but Isabel sat up straighter. Dovzhenko shot her a glance, getting the gist of it. And then the traffic began to slow. What? Ryan asked, leaning forward to rest on the seat. Isabel held up an open hand to shush him. The speaker droned on for another 15 seconds, and then the station returned to Persian pop.
There are protests ahead, Isabel said. We will have to go around.
Where ahead? Ryan asked.
Hard to know, Dovzhenko said. It is difficult for protesters to communicate with phones and social media dampened by authorities. This announcer was helping, telling people where to show up, but he was interrupted in the middle of his report. Somewhere to the west of the city. That is not enough to know.
The hospital is west of the city, Ryan said. Isabel tuned the radio past more music stations until she found another news program.
Here, she said. She translated as she listened. This is a government radio station, so the announcer is urging everyone to stay away. He assures law-abiding citizens that the authorities will be on hand to quell any violence on the part of the protesters.
Or bring their own violence, Dovzhenko said.
Traffic was at a virtual standstill now. Ryan had seen video of recent demonstrations. Tehran, Isfahan, Qom, all across Iran. With 3 million people, Mashhad had enough youth to pack the streets, and they often did. The Hilux inched along, covering less than a mile in the next 20 minutes. Impatient drivers changed into and out of the lane ahead each time there was an opening. So far, there had been no place to turn off that was not also jammed. They didn't see the policemen until they'd crested a small hill. By then, it was too late. A young, clean-shaven man, he was dressed in the black knee boots of a motorcycle officer. His bike, a Chinese BMW knockoff, was parked on the shoulder of the roadway. Another motor officer worked the second lane, each of them scanning the interior of each vehicle, pointing, giving direction to avoid the protests ahead.
The guns, Dovzhenko asked, without turning around.
They're covered, Ryan said.
It's going to be tough to explain my ear.
You don't speak Farsi, Isabel said. Your ear is the least of our worries.
The officer gave a friendly but official wave as he approached the driver's side window.
Okay, Dovzhenko said. I will do the talking.
He rolled the window down, giving Ryan a blast of sulfur fumes from the dirty gasoline manufactured in Iran. The officer leaned down to look in the window, at which point Dovzhenko showed him a credential case and barked something to him in accented Persian. He was polite but curt, as if he wanted the officer to clear away the traffic for him. The officer took the leather case and perused it for a moment before handing it back. He whistled to his partner, shouting something Ryan couldn't quite hear, let alone understand, before pointing to the shoulder of the road in front of the two bikes. Ryan's stomach fell when he thought they were ordering the truck to pull over. But the officer held traffic long enough for Dovzhenko to inch over and speed along to the next exit, where he passed under the highway, to loop well south of downtown.
What was that all about? Ryan asked.
Dovzhenko released a long captive sigh.
I showed him my embassy credentials and asked where the counter-protest was.
Counter-protest?
Mullahs and other community leaders, Isabel said. They are paid by the government to march in counterpoint to these student-led demonstrations. A bunch of old men in white turbans, as opposed to a bunch of youth in all manner of clothing. The Basij militia volunteers, who aren't busy cracking the heads Nima mentioned, will march with them.
How did you know there would be a counter-protest? Ryan asked. Did the radio mention that too?
Isabel shook her head. There is always a counter-protest. The government makes certain of that.
She covered a yawn, then pointed at the sign alongside the road.
The hospital is 3 kilometers away. Tell me again all that you know about this man, Yazdani.
Ryan got in the front passenger seat while they waited for Isabel to finish her work inside Akbar Children's Hospital. They parked the truck inconspicuously among the buildings of the nearby university. It was the first chance he and Dovzhenko had had to talk out of her presence when they weren't busy in hot pursuit.
You did well back there, Jack said, his forebrain telling him he should try and break the ice. He was exhausted to the point where his skin hurt, irritable, and in no mood to be social.
Still, whatever his credentials, this Russian spy had helped save Isabel. And for that, Ryan owed him.
As did you, Dovzhenko said. You do not appear to be a... how should I say this? A garden variety case officer for CIA.
Thanks, Ryan said. I guess.
Look, you're eventually going to be debriefed by people well above my pay grade. But just so we're clear, you only know Isabel because of a mutual friend?
Dovzhenko nodded.
There is no need to worry about my intentions toward Ms. Kashani. I was friends with a friend of hers. Our relationship goes no further than that.
Jack looked at him, thinking. He didn't say it, but those were the exact circumstances under which he and Isabel had met and become lovers. He hated to admit it, but the easy way she and Dovzhenko communicated with each other, absent screwed up more recent events, seriously bugged him.
Knock it off, Jack, he said to himself. You stopped pursuing her. Let her do her thing now, whatever it is, and with whoever she wants to.
I'm not worried, Jack said.
Then, for some inexplicable reason, he shot any possibility he had with Isabel in the foot.
Dude, you're the one who should worry. You've as much as said you were in love with her best friend, and then when she was killed, you tossed your own safety to the wind and went out of your way to save Isabel's life.
Dovzhenko closed his eyes, swallowing hard.
But you came without question when she called for help. Your ear was nearly torn off. Do not forget, you saved her from a kidnapping. 2 kidnappings.
Yeah, Ryan said. Forgive me for saying it this way, but you're heartbroken. I can't compete with that.
Be honest, Dovzhenko said. Are you really trying to?
Ryan surprised himself with the answer, and how quickly he gave it.
No, he said.
No, I guess I'm not.
He could almost hear John Clark's baritone voice.
You're finally growing up, kid.
Ryan banged his head softly against the side window, suddenly feeling like he'd shucked a tremendous load, despite the rest of the situation.
I just want her to be happy. Happy and safe.
Happiness does not come from safety, Dovzhenko said.
You got that right, Jack said, nearly jumping out of his skin when Isabel knocked on the window.
I got the address, she said, when he opened the door.
She hooked a thumb over her shoulder so Jack would give back her seat.
What are you two talking about? Nothing,
they said in unison. The New York Times had once described the White House Situation Room as a low-tech dungeon. The 5,000-square-foot complex across from the Navy Mess had seen considerable renovation since then. Coaxial cables and cathode ray tubes were replaced with Ethernet, secure routers and flat-screen monitors, bringing it well into the 21st century. But it was still a dungeon as far as Jack Ryan was concerned. It was too maudlin to say aloud, but the decisions made over this conference table were rarely good ones. More often than not, people died. Sometimes a lot of people. The mood today mirrored his own. Tense, agitated, spoiling for a fight. And no matter how hard Ryan tried, he couldn't seem to tamp it back. Most of the NSC assumed he was on edge because of the immediate danger of Iran having nuclear weapons. That was certainly a large part of it. They were aware American operatives inside Iran were about to try and turn an agent, but only Mary Pat knew of Jack Jr.'s involvement. Ryan studied the flat screen that took up much of the wall at the end of the table. It displayed a large topographic map of Iran. Major Patit's tablet computer ran Pentagon encryption, and after some tweaking by the Air Force major serving as the IT specialist on watch, it was connected to the Situation Room system. Patit used a stylus on the tablet to draw a white circle on the big screen around Mashhad and a smaller red circle around the 14th Tactical Air Base south of the city. "We believe their radar defense systems reach out at least 500 kilometers," Patit said. "Satellite surveillance shows Mirage F-1EQ fighters as well as Shahab-3, and several advanced anti-aircraft missile systems are based at this location." It wasn't Patit's job to say whether or not an air incursion by the United States was feasible at this point, not with at least a dozen people who outranked him in the room. He gave the facts and let them ask questions, which they did. A lot. Ryan waited for a lull and then looked at Mary Pat, who was seated halfway down the table next to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. "Remind me what NRO has flying over that part of the world." Foley answered without referring to her notes. USA-161 will pass over again in 7 hours. Mentor 6, an advanced Orion bird, covers that area as far as SIGINT goes. Advanced Orion, or Mentor, was a class of spy satellite run by the National Reconnaissance Office. Unlike the Keyhole satellites in low Earth orbit, which overflew a given location twice a day, Mentors were parked at various spots approximately 22,000 miles above the Earth's surface in geostationary orbit, gleaning signals intelligence, such as telephone, radio, and television, from an assigned location. "We're working on the feed from the last USA-161 pass, so we're ready to do comparisons immediately." Ryan made a note in his folder. "Let's get a couple more Sentinels over flying Mashhad." He turned his gaze to Air Force Lieutenant General Jason Paul. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, his background was in intelligence. He was a steady man who thought more than he spoke, and Ryan greatly respected his opinion. "Any new glitches in command and control?"
"No, Mr. President," General Paul said. "The agency has logged several thousand hours in Iranian airspace. They suspect, but do not appear to know the birds are up there."
In 2011, Iran claimed to have wrested control of an RQ-170 Sentinel that had violated its airspace. In truth, there had been a glitch on the U.S. end. The stealth technology rendered the bird invisible to Iranian radar, and they'd been unaware of its presence until the computer glitch. Unfortunately, they had been prepared to exploit it once they were. They also claimed to have reverse-engineered an RQ-170 of their own, called the Sayagheh, or Thunderbolt, but had yet to demonstrate they could utilize their clone to any effect. "Very well," Ryan said. "I'd like pros and cons of both missile strikes and aircraft sorties within the hour. Let's be ready to act when the KH-161 or one of the Sentinels give us actionable pictures." Ryan pushed away from the table. "Mary Pat, I'd like to see you in the office." "How about the medication for the Iranian boy if his father flips?" Ryan asked, once they'd returned to the Oval. Both carried cups of coffee from the Navy mess. Foley sat down in her customary spot on the couch. "From the sound of things, he's suffering from cystic fibrosis, specifically the F508del mutation. The illness is controllable with new drugs, but they are extremely expensive, to the tune of $290,000 a year here in the States. We'll use PL-110 to get the family in the country and to pay for the medication." Among other things, Public Law 110 was used to fund what was essentially the CIA's version of the Witness Protection Program. High-value assets could be given new identities, backgrounds, and in the case of Ibrahim Yazdani, necessary medical treatment. Ryan gave a low groan. Helping a gravely ill child was a laudable thing. The chance that he might have to withhold that help if the father didn't play ball made his bones hurt. "It's up to them now," he said. "So you've had a little time to mull. I want to hear a pro's thoughts on Eric Dubchenko." Mommy dearest, Zakhara Dubchenko, was a KGB counterintelligence officer until the collapse of the USSR. "You ever go up against her?" Ryan asked. "Back in the day when you were in Moscow?" Foley shook her head. "I heard plenty about her, though. She was a savvy operative, Azeri by birth, had a bit of a reputation as a vindictive drunk. Her jacket says she was pretty eaten up with the job. Drank, fought, and screwed a lot when she was younger. Reputation of a cowboy. Volunteered for all sorts of dangerous stuff." Ryan chuckled. "Sounds like somebody else I know." "Hey," Foley said, acting incredulous. "I was a nice drunk. And except for interludes with Ed, my knees could have held an aspirin in place. They were so firmly closed during that portion of my career." "I meant the reputation for being a cowboy." Foley's eyes sparkled with a grin. "I know. I just like to see you blush. My point is, having a super spy for a mother could not have made for an easy childhood. Just like here, intelligence work in Russia is a family business. Not too much of a leap to think Mommy pushed him that direction." "His father?" "An academic," Foley said. "One of those," Ryan said. "An academic himself. Anyway, if he was pushed into a career he didn't want, it would explain his motivation for turning. Or it could mean he's an extremely sophisticated operative, setting a trap that will blow up in our face." "Maybe," Foley said, "but they've been in Iran a while now. I think it would have blown already if it was going to." "Let's hope so," Ryan said. Foley took a sip of her coffee. "Your son's a smart guy, Jack. No one pushed him into this business. He's got the genes for it, and the drive." She sighed, closing her eyes for a moment as if deep in thought. "What?" Ryan asked. "Doesn't this remind you of the old days, when we were getting Colonel Mikhail Semyonovich Filitov out of the Kremlin?" "They don't make them like Cardinal anymore," Ryan said.
"I was thinking about that," Foley said. "Maybe they do."
Chapter 56 Reza Kazem set the technical manual on the ground, weighting the pages down with a stone against the wind, and looked over the hood of the nearby missile transport vehicle at the approaching Bell 206. Kazem smiled serenely, not because he was happy to see the helicopter, but because he needed the practice. Ayatollah Gorbani could not help himself, though he would stay in the rear of the aircraft, out of sight to the dozens of men working on the missile launcher and transport erector vehicles. His presence was still a distraction of monumental proportions. Kazem found Gorbani to be a necessary evil, a means to an end. The cleric put on a pious face, issuing fatwa after fatwa, extolling the virtues of Iranian manufacturing while decreeing all things Western an abomination before Allah. He instructed his officers in the IRGC to utilize only Iranian-made helicopters, such as the Shahed, while he trusted his own safety to nothing other than his personal jet ranger. It was these little things that made Reza Kazem hate the man. But hate him he did. He patted the sidewall of the huge tire on the missile transport truck as he watched the helicopter land at the edge of the rocky clearing 100 meters away. No, it would not be long at all. He whistled over the two men he'd chosen to drive the gargantuan vehicle. They'd been eating soup from foam cups that they dropped on the ground immediately when he summoned them. "You have the coordinates," he asked once they'd scurried to him. Neither was yet 30 years old, the crystal surety of youth unmarred by the skepticism of age and experience. "We do," they said in earnest unison. Kazem wondered what these earnest young dissidents would have thought had they known that the leader of the Council of Guardians, a man second only to the Supreme Leader himself, was on board the approaching helicopter. "Take a squad of the others and move this truck to the caves," he said. "Wait there until tonight, when the American satellite has passed overhead,
and then proceed to the coordinates. The two men gave curt nods. Yes, Aga Kazem, they said, using the Persian honorific similar to Mr. in the English-speaking world. Ayatollah Gorbani's helicopter beat the air, throwing up a cloud of dust and gravel as it settled in. Reza Kazem sniffed, gathering up the patience he'd need to show deference to such a prig. On one side of the clearing, Dr. Sahar Tabrizi, the Iranian-born genius of astrophysics, checked and rechecked one of the two Russian missiles that had become her pet projects. A genuine smile spread over Reza Kazem's lips. Soon, he would not need Gorbani at all. Major Sassani had kept the information about Nima's satellite phone call close hold, rather than turn it over to close IRGC detachment. Too much information was lost when it passed between too many ears and mouths. He wanted to pay the girl a personal visit, to hear from her lips where Dovzhenko had gone. The 324-kilometer journey from Herat to Mashhad via IRGC Dassault Falcon 20 business jet took less time than the drive from the airport to the neighborhood near the shrine of the Imam, where technicians had vectored Nima's probable location. Sassani arrived less than 3 hours from the time he first heard of the young woman's call with a satellite phone, believed to be in the possession of the Russian traitor, Eric Dovzhenko. Though the technicians tracking the phone were unable to get a precise location, it was painfully easy to find Nima's apartment. The first person Sassani asked, a scowling woman wearing a black chador and carrying a plastic shopping bag, pointed to the alley stairs. Harajai, she sneered. Literally everywhere. It was the Persian euphemism for streetwalker or prostitute. The woman had on a considerable amount of makeup, leading Sassani to think she might be turning in her competition. He'd met and even employed the services of plenty of whores who wore the chador. Promiscuous dress certainly led to sinful behavior, but a scandalous heart often hid beneath conservative clothing. Sassani laughed inwardly at the thought. His own blushing bride was a perfect example of the impurity that could hide under a chador. He was reasonably sure she'd slept with several men before their marriage, but her virginity meant less to him than the connection to the general made possible by their union. Sassani shooed the woman in the chador away and then stood in the alley, studying the painted staircase. He wondered idly how long ago Eric Dovzhenko's feet had stood on the worn treads, if Isabel Kashani had been with him. The major put a finger to his lips, warning his lieutenant to be quiet as they crept up the stairs. A door creaked open when they were nearly at the top. A face peeked out. She was small, looking like a child next to the door, young and pretty in the worn-out way that Sassani preferred. A green cotton headscarf was draped over her head, but not tied. "I am just leaving," she said. She attempted to push the door shut, but the lieutenant bounded up and put his foot on the threshold. She cursed, threatening to cut off vital parts of the lieutenant's body if he did not remove his foot. Sassani smiled serenely. "Let me speak with her," he said, stepping up. When her eyes turned toward him, he leaned in, as if to explain why they were there, and then punched her hard on the tip of her nose. He followed the punch inside the small apartment. It smelled like a whore's apartment. Tea and makeup and stale cigarettes. Sassani found there was something earthy about the odor that deeply appealed to him. Prostitutes saw more than their share of physical violence and were not easily intimidated by it. Sassani had come prepared and readied a syringe while the lieutenant tied the woman and threw her face down on the bed. She pressed her broken nose against the sheets, attempting to stop the flow of blood brought on by the punch through the door. The lieutenant put a knee in the small of her back, grabbing her by the hair and yanking sideways. Sassani found a vein in the side of her neck. Not difficult, since fear and exertion caused them to bulge like purple cables under her olive skin. He injected the contents of the syringe, leaving a dot of blood as he withdrew the needle and stepped away. She thrashed for a few more moments, but the lieutenant kept his knee in place. "Eric Dovzhenko," Sassani whispered. "Is he coming back?" "No." "Where is he?"
Nima broke like a cheap clay pitcher when the drugs began to take effect, spilling information so fast that Sasani and his assistant had a difficult time keeping up. The mixture of scopolamine and morphine wasn't exactly a truth serum, but they did induce a state of confused drowsiness that threw the subject off balance, left her feeling out of control, more effective, if less rewarding, than physical violence. In less than 10 minutes, Sasani knew Dovzhenko and the woman had gone to Akbar Children's Hospital to find where someone lived. She did not appear to know the name of that person. Rather than continue with the interrogation, the major decided it was better to finish here and go on to the next location. The Russian was close enough to smell now. Sasani would find him and kill him tonight. Sasani took another vial from his pocket and filled up the syringe.
What are you giving me?
The young woman's speech was slurred as if she were drunk. Sasani cocked a head to one side. I'm afraid. You'll need to be an example. Tears ran down the young woman's cheeks, mixing with the blood and mucus.
You do not have to worry. I swear it.
Oh, we are beyond worry, Sasani said.
This would have been so much easier had you only answered my questions before I administered the drug. Nima's face screwed into a stricken grimace as Sasani injected the contents of the second syringe into the same bulging vein in her neck.
But you never ask me anything until after you drugged me.
Sasani sat on the edge of the bed. I didn't, he said. Funny. I thought I did. He patted her on the buttocks, giving his lieutenant a conspiratorial nod.
Oh, well, it is better this way. We have what we need, and you are nothing but a corruption.
Chapter 57 Atash Yazdani answered the door on the first chime as if he'd been expecting them. He was a slightly built man with narrow shoulders, stooped by the weight of his son's illness. He'd not always been so slight. His slacks were bunched behind two new holes that had been punched in a tattered leather belt as he'd lost weight. A colorless white dress shirt hung off his body, the sleeves rolled up over bony forearms. A quintessential engineer, he had a cheap ballpoint pen and three mechanical pencils in his breast pocket. The forelock of his dark hair was pulled upward to a must point, as if he'd been clutching it in thought while bent over a desk or table in his tiny apartment. Dovzhenko had a pang of conscience when he saw the man's bloodshot eyes. He'd lost his wife to ovarian cancer. His son was gravely ill. Now they would offer salvation if he would only betray his country.
May I help you? The man asked, preoccupied, probably with the vagaries of life itself.
Dovzhenko smiled, hoping the guilt didn't show.
My friends and I have news that might help your son.
One hand on the door, the other on the frame, Yazdani leaned half out into the hallway, looking to see who Dovzhenko meant by friends. Isabel gave a polite bob of her scarf-covered head. The American smiled, but kept his mouth shut as they'd planned.
My son, Yazdani said. What do you know of my son?
Hope flashed momentarily in the man's eyes, but faded quickly, too overwhelmed with defeat to stay long.
May we discuss it inside?
Yazdani stood and stared for so long Dovzhenko was afraid the American might say something, if only to fill the void. Then the engineer suddenly opened the door and motioned them inside. The interior of the small apartment was as shabby and sad as the harried engineer's countenance. Ryan and Isabel took seats on the tattered sofa, and Dovzhenko, who was to make the initial pitch, took the faded Queen Anne next to the wobbly dining room chair where Yazdani would sit. As per Persian custom, the host brought out tea and a plate of cake, along with a sharp knife to cut it. He apologized that he did not have more to offer.
Now, he said, foregoing any tea himself, please tell me what it is you could do to help my son.
He turned toward Ryan.
You are American.
Ryan nodded, one eye on the kick knife. What made you guess that?
Yazdani scoffed. You have not yet spoken, so I knew you had something you wanted to hide. If you'd been Russian like him, that would not have mattered. Am I wrong?
You are not, Ryan said.
How did you injure your head?
A car wreck in Afghanistan, Ryan said.
I see, Yazdani mused, clearly trying to make sense of these sudden arrivals. You know much of my son's disease. Are you a doctor, then?
I am not, Ryan said.
None of us are physicians, Dovzhenko said. We are diplomats who believe we have come upon a way to help your son.
He took a sip of tea, letting the man stew on that a bit.
Diplomats. How would Russian and American diplomats know of the troubles of one Iranian boy? He glared at Isabel. What does this have to do with you?
I am a part of it, she said, but I am not the one who first knew of your child. Her honesty came through loud and clear on her words, obviously impressing Yazdani.
Dovzhenko set the teacup down on a side table.
I am truly sorry about your son. He has cystic fibrosis, does he not?
That is so.
The F508 del mutation, to be exact. You know a great deal, Yazdani said.
Now Ryan spoke. That particular mutation responds to a drug called tezacaftor. Yazdani threw back his head like he was in pain.
What good does this information do my Ibrahim? I earn 17 million rial each month, roughly 350 American dollars. This drug you speak of costs $300,000 a year. And that does not even matter, because we could never get it here anyway.
The room fell silent for a time. Everyone sipped tea to be polite, but the cake went untouched. At length, Yazdani leaned forward, bony elbows on bony knees.
It is obvious that you want something from me, he said.
A quid pro quo in order to help my son.
What is it?
Dovzhenko smiled serenely, the pang of conscience returning with a vengeance.
We can guarantee your son will receive the care and medication that he needs for the rest of his—
Yes, yes, Yazdani said. I understand what you offer. I want to know what you ask.
Dovzhenko shot a glance at Ryan. The Americans were offering the deal, so it was natural that he should complete the pitch. Ryan began.
You work with missile control systems at Mashhad Air Base?
Yazdani threw up his hands.
I knew it would have something to do with my job.
You are not diplomats. You are spies. Saboteurs.
We are.
Isabel nodded at Dovzhenko and then Ryan in turn.
He is Russian. He is American, and I am Iranian. That is the truth. None of us enjoys putting you in this position. But please, for the sake of the people of all our countries, help us so we can help your son.
Yazdani closed his eyes. His narrow shoulders drew back, a little more erect despite this added burden. But he did not say no. Major Parviz Sassani eased the passenger door of his rental car shut so it didn't make a noise. Dovzhenko had proven to be adept quarry, so he would take every precaution. Well, the Russian wasn't truly adept. He'd bested Taliban smugglers, yes, but then he'd allowed some pitiful whore to use his satellite phone, sending up a virtual signal letting Sassani know where to look. The nurse at the children's hospital had been too terrified not to help. Perhaps she smelled the death on him from the recent interaction with the Nima woman. He'd seen the phenomenon before. His own children sometimes recoiled when he approached them after a particularly grisly day, though they could have no idea what he'd done. He'd have to do a more in-depth study, see if he could use it to his advantage during interrogations. The nurse hadn't recognized the photo of Dovzhenko. But as soon as he'd shown her a photo of Isabel Kashani, she'd been quick to provide the details of this Yazdani fellow. They were closing in now. Just as the nurse had smelled death on him, Sassani smelled the tension of the fleeing Russian. Yes, very close.
Perhaps we should telephone for reinforcements, the lieutenant said, shoving the keys to the rental inside the pocket of his slacks.
That won't be necessary, Sasani said. We are talking about one woman and a Russian operative whose heart was never in this line of work anyway. If the two of us cannot handle them, we are in the wrong business.
The lieutenant press-checked the chamber of his Sig Sauer handgun, as was IRGC policy before a raid, and then screwed a suppressor on the end of the threaded barrel.
Shoot on sight, then.
I would like to take the time to interrogate him, Sasani said, then thought better of it. No, the Russians would only rescue him. Shoot Dovzhenko on sight. We'll take the girl back to Evin and deal with her there.
The lieutenant looked down the sight of his weapon before returning it to his belt, the suppressor extending out the bottom of the open scabbard holster.
I have been thinking, Major. Perhaps this man, Yazdani, is some kind of spy.
Sasani scoffed.
I do not think so. Our Russian friend is a fugitive. He would have to run away to Russia. But I imagine General Aleph wants him dead as badly as we do. He's running out of options and attempting to find refuge with any friend he can.
But how could Yazdani be his friend? Dovzhenko did not even know where he lived.
He has recently moved to be near the hospital. Beyond that, Dovzhenko knew the man well enough to know he has a sick son and which hospital he is a patient in.
Sasani pulled up a photograph of Atash Yazdani on his phone and held it so the lieutenant could see.
Look at him. He would blow away if he walks out into this wind. He is an engineer of no consequence. We will be doing a service to put him out of his misery.
It's a difficult call, Ryan concluded. I get that. We all do. And there will be danger involved. But there's no way this turns out any way but bad without your help.
Ryan wasn't a counterintelligence officer. He knew the basics, from books Clark had assigned him. But the act of turning someone to act as an agent for the United States was two parts art and one part science. It took time. Time they did not have. This pitch had come off more heavy-handed than he'd intended, but that couldn't be helped. He had to be bald about what they needed and hope Isabel could pull cleanup, appealing to Yazdani's sense of right and wrong, reminding him that he was helping the Iranian people rather than betraying them.
Yazdani's head suddenly snapped up as he looked at the door.
What is it? Dovzhenko asked. There is a loose board in the hallway, the engineer said. That is how I heard you coming before you knocked.
Ryan got to his feet. Are you expecting company? The engineer shook his head.
You are the first visitors I have had in weeks. Did you leave someone outside to keep watch?
Dovzhenko pulled the engineer to the side at the same moment the door crashed inward, kicked open by a heavy boot. There had been no handguns to liberate from the Taliban, and they'd left the rifles in the car, leaving them unarmed.
Hello, Comrade Eric,
a sneering Iranian man said, his own gun in both hands, pointed at Dovzhenko.
Sasani,
the Russian spat. A second man came through the door, a suppressed pistol raised, ready to fire. The first man started to say something else, but Isabel flew at him in a rage, batting his pistol aside, screaming, clawing at his face. Jack made good use of the distraction and closed the distance to the second Iranian, parrying the pistol away with his left arm while he swung upward with his right to plant a staggering hammer fist to the man's unprotected groin. The extra inches of suppressor on the muzzle of the handgun made it slightly more difficult to maneuver effectively. Jack exploited the lag in speed, trapping the gun in both hands and driving the other man backward against the wall with the point of his elbow. Stunned, the man swung with his left, attempting to hit Jack in the head when he should have tried to secure his gun. One of the blows, robbed of its full power, impacted Jack's injured ear, bringing a wave of nausea. Ryan growled, clearing his head. With the handgun pinned to the wall, he drove a knee over and over into the man's groin and thigh at the same time, throwing elbows at his throat. The Iranian slid down to protect his groin, then used the wall as a brace as he used the force of his legs to push upward, trying to shake Ryan's grip. The pistol barked, suppressed, but not nearly silent, sending a round dangerously close to Ryan's face. Invigorated by the near miss, Ryan followed the upward transition of movement, twisting his own center at the same time he stepped inward, impacting the man's armpit with the point of his shoulder, spinning toward the gun. The man peeled off the wall as Ryan followed him through the turn, throwing him violently on his back while retaining his two-handed grip on the pistol. He was vaguely aware of the fight going on behind him. He'd heard furniture break, Isabel's cry as she fell, and Dovzhenko's frenzied yowl as he attacked Sasani. There had been no other shots, and Ryan had his own hands full. The Iranian turned out to be better on the ground than he was standing up. Straddling the man in the mount position, Ryan slammed the gun hand against the floor, sending another shot into the far baseboard. The Iranian bucked his hips upward and to the side, attempting a throw. With both hands occupied against the pistol, Ryan had to post, bringing forward a foot and planting it to the side of the Iranian's body to keep from tumbling over. Instead of returning to the mount, Ryan retained his grip on the gun and continued in the direction of his posted leg, pushing off and around over the top of the Iranian's head, lifting and turning, bringing the arm and the pistol around with him as he went. Ligaments tore. Tiny carpal bones snapped. The Iranian's finger convulsed on the trigger again, this round tearing downward through his gut at near point-blank range. Ryan pressed his advantage, his own finger finding the trigger now and sending two more rounds into the wide-eyed man's belly before resting the pistol away. He heard another yowl and spun, to find Dovzhenko seated on the ground, bleeding from the nose. Isabel, too, was on the ground, on all fours, dazed, her scarf gone, trying to get back in the fight. Major Sasani had sunk to his knees, the knife from the cake sticking from the side of his neck. Blood arced from the wound in time with his pulse, painting Yazdani, who stood over him. The IRGC man croaked, unable to speak from the blade that bisected his voice box. He toppled forward a moment later, the arc of blood slowing to a trickle as his life ebbed away. The other Iranian coughed behind Ryan, causing him to turn with the suppressed SIG. The wounded man shrank backward, shielding his face from another shot. He writhed on the carpet, eyes clenched in excruciating pain. Dovzhenko helped Isabel to her feet. She tended to a shaken Yazdani while the Russian stood beside Jack.
"Hospital," the Iranian whispered. "Please."
Dovzhenko knelt.
"Lieutenant Gul," he said.
He looked at the wounds, then shook his head.
"I am afraid there is no time. I will pass on a message to your wife."
"Thank you,"
Gul said. He coughed again. Pink blood foamed at the corners of his lips now, indicating at least one of the shots had nicked a lung. Ryan guessed another had hit the liver.
"Why?" Dovzhenko asked. "Why was Sasani after Mariam? What was so special about the three students? And why me, for that matter?"
"Olaf ordered it."
Dovzhenko's mouth fell open.
"General Olaf of the GRU."
Gul nodded weakly.
"I am so cold."
His voice was like the air escaping a punctured ball. Yazdani brought a small throw blanket from the couch and draped it over the young man, situating it with trembling fingers.
"Why?" Dovzhenko asked again. "Why Mariam?"
"She saw them. Together. Like the students."
Dovzhenko groaned. He thought it strange when he'd seen the picture, but it didn't seem enough to kill over.
"Olaf and Reza Kazem."
Gul shook his head.
"Not Olaf."
His lips and teeth were bathed in pink blood.
I, the woman."
The man was drifting now, forcing Dovzhenko to lean forward to hear his words. Gul's eyelids fluttered.
"My son, he is only little boy."
The coughing came again, more ragged now. He looked up at Dovzhenko, eyes wide, back arched, racked with pain.
"Please."
He collapsed against the rug. Still. Jack looked at Isabel, then Dovzhenko, assessing them for wounds. He scooped up the suppressed SIG and popped the magazine. 5 rounds left. He did a quick peek into the hallway, miraculously saw no one, and then pushed the door closed. The jamb was splintered on the inside, but he hoped the damage wouldn't be too noticeable from the exterior. Blood covered Yazdani's hands and chest. He'd been the one to stab Major Sasani in the neck with the kick knife.
Thank you, Ryan said. The engineer sniffed, regaining his composure. Your thanks are unnecessary. If you are dead, you will be unable to help my son. That is all that matters to me.
So you'll help us? Ryan asked.
I will, Yazdani said.
I'm a little worried about all the noise, Dovzhenko said. If your neighbors call the police, we are in trouble.
Do not worry, Yazdani said. I am an unhappy man. My neighbors are accustomed to hearing me cry and throw things.
Isabel ran a hand over the bullet holes in the floor and doorframe.
Fortunately, none of them went all the way through.
We're interested in two missiles in particular, Ryan said.
I thought as much, Yazdani said. Russian 51T6s.
Exactly, Ryan said. We need to know where they are.
First, Yazdani said, how will we get my son to the United States?
It should be straightforward to get you both across the border to Herat, Ryan said. From there, you'll travel by military transport to the United States. The engineer pondered this.
I feel as though I should wait to help you until my son is out.
That won't work, Ryan said. There are too many variables. We're not even sure who is in charge of this conspiracy. Too much of a chance they'll fire the missiles. We need to figure out their target.
How will I know you will keep your end of the bargain?
Isabel bit her bottom lip, gathering her thoughts.
All we can offer is our word, she began. But these men saved my life. Twice.
I have no choice. Do I? I am sorry, Dovzhenko said. You do not.
Yazdani's stooped shoulders slumped even more.
They've moved the missiles west of Mashhad, he said. They are on mobile launchers manufactured in Iran. But I wouldn't worry about the targets. I saw the firing solutions.
Ryan waited, but Yazdani just looked at him, waiting to be prodded over the edge, as if he had not quite committed treason until this moment. Okay, Ryan finally said.
You will think me foolish, Yazdani said, but the firing solutions I saw aim the missiles at space. These solid fuel rockets are not powerful enough, but it is as if they are planning to launch a satellite.
Chapter 58. John Clark and the others were still at the safe house in Portugal, waiting for Exville when Ryan got through. Keep it short, Clark said. You're going to need to move right away after we hang up. I'm not on the sat phone, Jack assured him. This guy has a proxy server he's been using to get around government firewalls so he can look for medication for his kid. I'm using that to jump on an anonymized encrypted VOIP, so we should be good.
Roger that, Clark said. Our guest is handcuffed to a chair in the back room. I'm putting you on speaker. We're all here.
Ryan checked on Dom, who was still receiving treatment at Bagram before transport to Rammstein, and then ran down the information Yazdani had given him, using the Iranian's digraph plus code name. We're trying to work out a way for S.D. Flint to help clear a way for our guys, in case they need to pay a little visit to the missile site.
Glad you're okay, Ding Chavez said, ever the mother hen, even from thousands of miles away. We'll have to get clearance from higher, but maybe Gavin can come up with malware he can send you in a zip file or something.
I'm conferencing him in now, Clark said. 20 seconds later, Gavin Beery joined the conversation. 2 minutes after that, he was up to speed on the situation.
I don't need to email him anything, Beery said, as long as he hasn't lost his thumb drive.
I lost it, Ryan said, but I got it back again.
You're good to go then, Beery said.
Seems too simple, Midas said. Your malware phone's home when the computer connects to the internet. Wouldn't the Iranians be using a closed system for missile defense to guard against online attacks?
That is a very good question, Beery said, to which I have a very good answer. There are a couple versions of malware on the drives I gave you, the one you used in Spain that downloads automatically when you plug it in, and a worm that needs execution. Once the worm is embedded, the system will crash. It should blind missile defense radar for several minutes, depending on what kind of redundant systems they have.
Ryan talked to Yazdani for a moment, then came back on the line, deliberately avoiding the use of the engineer's cryptonym, S.D. Flint, in front of him. Our guy here says he can slow the backup system from coming online for a half hour or so, basically by turning off the alarms that would alert staff when the radar goes down. We'll need to coordinate, Clark said. I'll make a call, get marching orders regarding the malware, and specifics on your man's exfil and the medical requirements you've already briefed me on. Check with me in half an hour. In the meantime, Beery said, get a pen, and I'll give you the directions on how to execute the worm. The morning national security briefing was just drawing to a close when John Clark's call was pushed through to Mary Pat Foley, though no meeting on national security ever actually finished, and the Secretaries of State and Defense, as well as the Director of National Security, the Deputy National Security Advisor, and the Chief of Staff were in their customary spots in the Oval. I'm not crazy about a military incursion into Iran, Scott Adler said. Burgess harumphed. I say it's long overdue. I'll need to get my people working on rescue contingencies in the unlikely event one of our planes gets shot down. That's the least of our worries, Foley said, looking directly at Ryan. I agree, the president said. Let's look at what we know. Russia sold or gifted at least two nuclear missiles to elements in Iran that appear to be linked to Reza Kazem and his so-called Persian Spring Movement. We know Kazem had a meeting with our spy and erstwhile assassin Elizaveta Bobkova, and then later with General Olof of the GRU. Good catch on her, by the way, Van Damme said. Chadwick's death would have been bad. Especially for Chadwick, Foley offered. There's that, Van Damme said. But it would have been bad for the country. The tyrant dies, his rule has ended. The martyr dies, her rule begins. Ryan took a drink of his coffee. Taking liberties with your Kierkegaard, are you? Maybe I am, Van Damme said. It's true. He looked down at his notes, ready to move on. Why would Kazem want a nuke? Maybe his hands aren't quite as clean as he makes them out to be, Ryan said. It never made sense that Russia was sitting down at the table with him. It's in their best interest to prop up the mullahs. So Russia and the Ayatollah use Kazem as a proxy to strike at us and still remain blameless, Foley said. There's a certain ham-fisted elegance to it that reeks of both regimes. That's my guess, Ryan said. That still doesn't give us a target, Burgess said. No, Ryan said. It does not. I'm not a rocket scientist, Adler said. But do you think this Flint might be mistaken in his assessment on the trajectory? That's possible, Ryan said. Burgess spoke next. There's a high degree of probability that our Patriots could shoot down both Gorgons when they enter terminal phase, but the likelihood goes up exponentially if we know what the target is and can plan in advance. I suggest we have an expert talk to Flint, Mr. President, someone who knows the specific questions that need to be asked. That's wise, Ryan said, his subconscious mind working in the background on something he couldn't quite put his finger on. I wonder, Mary Pat said, tapping a fountain pen on her notepad. Both China and Russia have been working on anti-satellite lasers since my days in Moscow. We know China has the tech to shoot down a satellite. Russia has been testing its new Dawn missile for that very purpose. It's possible one of them shared what they know with Tehran. That's it, Ryan thought. That's what his subconscious had been stewing over. Dovzhenko and Jack moved Sasani's body, along with the other dead IRGC officer, into the bathroom, so they wouldn't be in full view if someone happened to stop in on Yazdani. For a time, Jack worried that the engineer might be distressed at having to look at the man he'd killed. But that didn't appear to be the problem. Yazdani was a man past distress, beyond tears, numbed by death and illness. Ryan had had little more than a couple of hours of sleep in the past 48. At least two of his ribs were probably cracked. One of his molars was chipped, and each beat of his pulse sent a wave of molten fire through his torn ear. His body desperately needed to rest and heal. But his mind hated these in-between moments. It gave him too much time to think. Like a fool, he'd built up a different end to this story when Isabel had called. So, he pressed Yazdani, tell me again about this firing solution.
For the third time, the engineer said, neither missile is aimed at anything on Earth. I suppose it is possible that they are launching satellites into low Earth orbit, but they have not removed the warheads as far as I know.